Welcome to the Kindlings Muse Podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, everybody, this is Dick Staub, and I want to welcome you to a special edition of the Kindlings Muse at Kindlings Fest on Orcas Island, where we have been having an amazing time, and we've just got beautiful weather and amazing speakers and so much fun. However, tonight we're going to continue discussing this subject of turning mourning into dancing, and we're going to get at it a little differently tonight. We're going to hear a few stories, and then we're going to have a little music. And those of you who are here at the event, if you're listening on podcast, this is the sound you're hearing is a film canister. Did everybody bring your film canister? Okay. Okay, good, excellent. In a minute, that's right. We're going to be using those tonight. In addition to taking on the subject of personal mourning, because as I've wandered around and talked to different ones of you, it's obvious that each of us have something in our journey that has been painful for us, and there have been incidents that have caused mournings in each of our lives. And we're going to hear a little bit more about that from one person that's here tonight. But we also want to get at a broader issue, which is we are part of a community. As a matter of fact, the Christian faith, the Jewish faith as well, we're really community expressions of faith, not just individual expressions. And as a result, a lot of what Jesus asks us to do is to step outside our concern for our own mourning and to step into the societal mourning that is all around us. If you think about the work that we're going to hear about with William Wilberforce or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, their faith took a very, very public stand on issues of justice and what is right and what is wrong. And so we wouldn't want to leave this place with a very individualistic view of what it means to think about mourning and to dancing. Because anybody that follows culture and reads the news knows that we have a culture and a world that is full of mourning and needs the love and grace and good news and light that we are supposed to bring into the darkness. So we're going to get into those issues a little bit tonight, and we're going to start with H. Spees. He spent years in community development. He's the Vice President of Network Growth and Development for Leadership Foundation. And I asked him to start tonight just by sharing some of his experience of turning mourning into dancing in his own life and work. And it's great to have him. Would you give a round of applause to H. Spees?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Dick, I need to say, first of all, that Terry's here with me, my wife, and this is our third Kindlings Fest.
Yes.
And we have been involved in urban ministry. We got married at the ripe old age of 19. In 1972, we beat the odds. And in our first year of marriage, God called us right after the Civil Rights Movement to move to Mississippi to work in a black-led organization called Voice of Calvary under a guy named John Perkins.
Yeah.
And so we spent the first 11 years there. Our family, our theology was formed in the cauldron of post-Civil Rights Mississippi. And we've given ourselves to that. That's sort of developed two main strains in our life. That was the trunk of the tree, and my branch has been urban ministry. So we now live in the highest crime, lowest income neighborhood in Fresno, California, and we work with, I get to serve on an international urban missions network called Leadership Foundation, 60 cities in Africa, Asia, and the U.S., a relatively young movement, 30 years old, where leaders in these cities are daring to operationalize the unity of the body of Christ to care for the soul of the city, especially the poor and the vulnerable. And my wife's branch of the tree has been to care for children who have been abused or neglected, born addicted to drugs. So she's led us, our family, on a years-long voyage of 12 foster kids, and now she actually, for the last 15 years, has overseen 3 nursing homes, 6 kids each, with kids coming right out of the neonatal intensive care unit that are born addicted to drugs or have been shaken babies because of violence in the home. We come here because you and this movement helped turn our mourning into dancing. And the same dynamics that are involved in addressing culture in the arts are those dynamics and disciplines and the need for community that we have as we address structures, principalities, powers, and systems and structures in urban environments, broken urban environments. And so we feel at home here. So thank you.
I want to obviously hear more about some of the stories, but how do people who are doing what you're doing, and how many kids do you have?
We have 6, 3 homegrown and 3 grafts.
Wow.
Right.
How do you pour out your lives in those situations and not lose heart? How do you, you know, you're talking about coming here because you need your morning to be turned into dancing. And as you were saying that, I can think of so many people I know who really feel called to the poorest of the poor, who, with the very best of intentions, commit to it, get into it, and then find out, I can't do this. I don't have it. I mean, it takes a special something to be able to sustain the weight of other people. Any pastor knows that when you start to know the stories, and you've been a pastor,
right,
when you start to know the stories of every person in your community and in your church, you begin to feel this weight on you.
Right.
You're not responsible for fixing everything, but you are aware.
Right.
And you want to bear their burden. And it can take you to the breaking point. Yeah. How have you guys done it?
Well, I think the real simple answer, and this is overly simplistic, but it is Jesus. And when you, we had, when a year and a half after moving into the neighborhood that we currently live in, our neighbor's son, next door neighbor's son, was shot and killed walking home from middle school. And I did the funeral. I did a ride-along one night, and I saw...
For people that don't know what a ride-along is.
Ride-along, you ride with a cop. You see, one of the things that we do in our city to identify with cops, who cops and elementary and public school teachers are the frontline ministry people in our community. So we do a lot of ride-alongs with cops. And one night, we got a call... and they make us wear a clergy collar, and I'm still not sure if that's to draw fire or to protect us, you know. But, you know, but we did this one ride along. The last call that night was party out of control, Northwest Fresno. And in Fresno, you spell success, N-O-R-T-H. So this means that when crime and violence penetrates the whole community, it isn't just something that you can pocket. And so we went to this place, we walked into the backyard, and I remember walking in and seeing on the ground DeAndre Singleton, 17-year-old kid who'd been shot point blank with a 25 caliber handgun. And his girlfriend came up and said, "Father," because she thought I was a priest. I kind of thought I was because I was wearing this clergy collar. And she said, "Would you pray for DeAndre?" And, you know, this is what we've been talking about here. It's the incarnation. At that moment, I prayed, and words came out of my mouth that was the Spirit of God praying for my kids, because that could have been my kid, because of the move we made. But praying for all kids, and they're all our kids. I mean, the ultimate thing is, you know, the two great weepers in the Bible were Nehemiah and Jesus when it comes to urban ministry. Nehemiah allowed the desperation of his city, even though he was Babylonian by this time. He was third generation. He didn't have to think about the old country. But because of that psalm that you read to us this morning, Nigel, he had God's people on his heart. So when he heard the desperation of Jerusalem, he wept. Mm-hmm. When Jesus... one of the great proofs of Jesus' divinity is what he does at points of power. So he's at the height of his power, Palm Sunday. People are pulling branches off the trees so that his donkey's feet don't touch the ground. And yet when he comes over the lip of that city, he doesn't believe the press. He weeps over the city. Jesus left the most secure gated community in the universe, the one with the pearly gates, to come to our hood. And we get to do that. And so when we follow him, when we realize it's his heart, and we become a part of his body, that is...
HP
that is
really, forgot to turn off his phone.
No. I timed 7 minutes. You gave me
no,
7.
No, okay. But we don't worry about time. We're living island time.
All right.
Is
okay,
that right?
All right. Well, let me tell you one story that typifies this, because I know you've got other folks that you want to get up there. But part of our movement, we've got leadership foundations in Pretoria and Delhi and Chiang Rai and Memphis and Salem and Chicago. But there's a kid that grew up, Stefan de Beer, grew up a white Afrikaner kid in Pretoria, South Africa, before the fall of apartheid. And he knew it was wrong as a white kid. Grew up, went to seminary to pursue Jesus. He and some seminary buddies, before the fall of apartheid, pulled together a little house for black street boys, homeless street boys on the streets of Pretoria. That pro-apartheid forces, a gang of pro-apartheid folks, in collusion with the police department, burned it down, and 6 kids were killed. And it crushed him. Mourning. He came to the U.S., and he discovered John Perkins and CCDA, discovered the Leadership Foundation movement, that were actually people in cities doing something. He went back to Pretoria, got 5 huge churches in Pretoria to come together to form a foundation. And they began to do the work. And they represent, they do so much of the work that maintains a very delicate balance in that difficult situation in South Africa still, that maintains peace after the fall of apartheid. They have an HIV hospice that returns 95% of their folks that are given to them terminally ill, turns them back to jobs and their families healthy. They've got, they're rescuing kids out of the sex trade. They've got 588 housing units under management for affordable housing for the poorest of the poor. They're doing incredible work, 118 staff, black and white and colored, and that's an actual word in South Africa. It's not a word that we use here in the U.S., but it's a picture of reconciliation. It's a picture of Jesus's broken heart. That guy, Stefan, one of my dear friends, is just one example of people across the world that are wrestling with the urban violence and seeing peace and shalom come by turning mourning, by allowing the mourning to penetrate their hearts, not running from it, but grabbing fear and pulling it to them and looking it in the eye in the power of Christ. And identifying, doing the incarnational thing and living in those situations, taking the body of Christ, relocating it into the most violent communities, and great dancing comes up out of that. Mm-hmm. But, it's a cycle. It never stops. You mourn and you dance, and then you dance and you mourn.
Hmm. Was there a story you want to tell us from Fresno? Was there some other?
Well, I think that one of the things that happened in Fresno was desperation became our best friend. We were a sleepy agricultural town in the middle of the world's most productive agricultural valley. And then in 1992, right at the time of the Rodney King riots, we discovered we had 128 gangs, 13,000 car thefts, and 100 homicides. We were a city that was literally losing its soul. And we had the highest per capita rates of violent crime of any city in California, including Oakland, San Jose, San Francisco, L.A. And what happened was the Spirit of God moved in a powerful way. Our mayor, our chief of police, some business leaders, some pastors, some ministry leaders came together, and we just said, you know what? We're going to nail our shoes down to the floor, and we aren't going to move until God uses us to change our city. And that group became a kind of a movement called the No Name Fellowship and began to take responsibility. And people were called to do unusual things like move into the inner city. And mm-hmm. One guy left. We had a pastor's prayer summit with all ethnicities represented, 40 pastors begging God for our city. Coming down, I'll never forget a friend of mine, Roger Manassian, had this huge church. He said, H, I think I'm supposed to leave my church. I said, what are you supposed to do? He said, I think I'm supposed to get gang kids jobs. And I said, Roger, you know, you are kind of like a geek, you know, but 1,600 gang members into real jobs later, Hope Now for Youth has been, so one thing after another, God began to raise up dancing out of the morning, but desperation was our best friend. Cities, I've spoken about stories like that in other cities, and cities can be in denial just like we are.
Yeah.
And those cities that push that down and don't listen to what their police chief and their elementary school teachers in the inner city and their cops see every day, if they don't listen to it, they don't see the future, they're in denial, wow, nothing gets done. Because if you don't embrace the morning, you never get to the dancing.
Why have evangelicals been kind of late to the game in many ways in urban ministry?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the great things about Eric's book, Wilberforce, Amazing Grace, is that it really does talk about historic evangelicals.
Exactly.
I think what I would say is that there are historic evangelicals and modern evangelicals. They both have the same theology of personal transformation. But historic evangelicals believed, people like Wesley and Wilberforce, believed that personal transformation is intrinsically connected to social transformation. That's what you do. That's who you are.
Yeah.
I think in our wealth, in our comfort, in our American complacency, we've allowed our evangelicalism to become uncoupled. Personal transformation is here, and then we've chosen very narrow set of issues like anti-homosexuality, like anti-abortion, pro-prayer in the schools. And we've made those things our social agendas, things that we can jump up and down on a table and scream about but never contact or touch or really be committed to or walk with another human being. And so I think there's a movement to restore a historic evangelicalism. I think that what we've heard so far in this conference leads us to being whole. It's like you said, Dick, it's a community thing. It's becoming the eyes and legs and arms and ears to each other that is the body of Christ, and letting Jesus stand up again in the hard places of our world, mm-hmm, and touch and heal and love and be present.
Hmm. Terry, would you come up for just a minute? Terry hates
Dick,
his wife.
She's going to hate you and me for this.
No, you could just hate me because he has nothing to do with it. I want you to sit next to the guy that you married when you were 19 and didn't know what you were doing.
I'm the extrovert. This is my dear wife, the introvert. Okay.
No, I love you, and I'm glad you're going to speak to me after this. Do you guys know "The Lord Bless You and Keep You"? Do you know that? Okay, Nigel, come over. I want us to just lay hands on these folks and pray a blessing on them. I want the Kindlings to send them back, knowing that they're loved and supported, and that we want you to be nurtured and refreshed, and that we know that you share a passion for the value of every human life just like we do, and you're putting hands and feet to it in places that many of us don't get to go.
And I'm going to put my hand out back there to the back of the room to Dave and Teresa Hillis. Dave is my boss and brother and president of Leadership Foundations.
Would you stand, Dave?
Dave and Teresa.
Why don't you guys stay standing and we'll sing to you too.
Amen.
What do you say, huh? Do you know the song I'm talking about? If you don't, fake it. Okay? Sincerely, though. It goes like this. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious, gracious, gracious to you. The Lord lift his countenance you. Okay, great. Wow, thank you, H. Spees. I'm going to ask Tara Ward to come up. She's going to sing for us. And real quick, Jenny Spohr, if you could come up. And after Tara finishes, we're going to talk to you for a minute. What we're hearing here is that it's important that we focus on the family, but we've got to start thinking of the family beyond our family. We've got to start realizing that we are part of a bigger family from God's perspective, and that we've got to learn how to love and care and invest in that family too. And that's one of the things we hope that everybody goes back. The idea of a kindling is that we're trying to start just a little something here, just a little flicker of something. And you have to take it back to your community and ask, what does that look like where you live, in your place? What can you do? Tara Ward is an amazing, amazing vocalist, and we're so glad she's with us. And she's also in love. She's getting married in a few weeks. Would you introduce us to your fiancé?
Yes, this is Nathaniel Washam.
What was the first name?
Nathaniel.
Stand up, Nathaniel. Come on, man. That's right. Let's give a big round of applause for them. And I understand that you are going to be singing something that was inspired by Henri Nouwen.
Yes, it's called Broken, and it's directly out of the book Life of the Beloved, which is about, it's about around the idea that we are all taken, blessed, broken, and given to the world, just like in communion.
Beauty, beautiful.
You are broken, I am broken, everyone is broken. You are broken, I am broken, intimately broken. You are broken, I am broken, everyone is broken. You are broken, I am broken, intimately broken. Stay, there's peace beyond anguish, life beyond death, love beyond fear. Stay, there is peace beyond anguish, life beyond death, love beyond fear. And we all have to suffer to enter our glory. You are broken, I am broken, everyone is broken. You are broken, I am broken, intimately broken. You are broken, I am broken, everyone is broken. You are broken, I am broken, intimately broken. Bless, bless, and do not curse. Pull brokenness far from the shadow of curse. Bless, bless, and do not curse. Pull your brokenness far from shadow of curse. Put it under the light of the blessing. Praise, praise to you, Lord, for I never realized broken glass could shine so brightly.
Another Kindling's Hearth alum who was at the same retreat as Susan Osborne. And that was one of the amazing things that night. We had a cellist there, too. And Jeff Johnson and some of the others of us were out on the deck doing things that silly boys do late at night. And we heard this angelic sound and walked in, and there the cellist, Susan, and Tyra were doing this amazing improvisational thing, including Nigel got in on it. I have it on tape, actually. We may play it sometime. It's a very kind of weak tape, but it was amazing. And I'm mentioning that because tomorrow morning, Tara and Susan are going to be doing something in the morning session. And I think it's going to be somewhat improvisational, and I know it'll be cool. Jenny Spohr is the producer of the Kindling's Muse since it first started in Seattle. However, she's had a few leave of absences.
Just one.
Well,
there's another coming.
We're coming in on another one. Those of you listening on podcast, she's great with child, I think, as the Bible says.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things that I love about Jenny, among many, is that she has a tremendous sense of justice and mm-hmm. concern about justice issues, and she keeps it on the table. And if any of us think we're going to get it off the table, not that we would want to, but sometimes it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take first place. She's always there to make sure that that voice is heard. And you've become very involved and interested in a ministry called International Justice Mission, and yeah. a lot of people know about it. Tell me about your involvement in it, what they're doing, and why it is one of the ways that we are getting involved in turning mourning into dancing.
You know, the founder of International Justice Mission, his name's Gary Haugen, and he was an investigator in the Rwandan genocide for the UN. And he was a civil rights attorney with the Department of Justice, which is actually my dream. When I was 8 years old, I wanted to be a civil rights attorney. So I just sort of connected with him on that level. I'm not an attorney, obviously. I play one on television, but I'm not one.
But her husband is one.
Yeah, my husband is one. So Gary was in Rwanda and basically standing, you know, amidst a sea, literally a sea. He was in a river of corpses and that mourning of not again, not again. I cannot let this happen again. And so he came back to the States and was praying about how he could be involved to help this never happen again. And what he saw at that time was that there were not organizations that were seeking justice actively for the poor and the oppressed through legal means. There were a lot of, you know, ways to stop oppression through feeding people and housing people and helping the sick and all of those things, which are obviously wonderful pursuits, but there was no one holding perpetrators accountable for the evil that they perpetrated on this earth. And so Gary started the International Justice Mission to use his skill set to be able to help people, and now they're in over 36 countries, modern day global forces all over this world, helping to eradicate mainly slavery, but also just legal injustices wherever they're found. The two major things that I've been involved with them is on the slavery side, and one of them is human trafficking in sex slavery, as well as in just your normal, quote unquote, normal slavery. And I actually had the honor of having a gentleman who was once a slave and is now free. He was in a brick kiln in South Asia and beaten daily, working for hours and hours and hours. His family was not allowed to ever leave the property, no matter if they got sick. If they got sick, they were beaten for being sick. It's just a horrible place. His, you know, little children, little five-year-old boy trying to haul bricks up and down and form bricks. And finally, someone was tipped off in the village that there was this group that tried to help, you know, people in slavery. And someone bravely met for tea with an International Justice Mission attorney, and they investigated it. So they go in with hidden cameras, and it's very Dateline, you know. They go in with their hidden cameras and check it out. And he, this gentleman, helped the IJM investigators to get a lot of this footage of the beatings and of the, you know, how it worked that they were enslaved. And IJM, through legal processes, you know, through using the police, slavery is illegal everywhere. It's not. I get asked a lot, like, whoa, what's going to happen to the economy if slavery goes away? And I look at them like, are you kidding me? It's it's illegal, you know. So they're working with the law, and so they'll bring the evidence to the police, and the police formed a raid and brought freedom to these people who now are have their own brick kiln that they have started as a collective. And so it's almost like a co-op, you know. And that's just been one of those blessings to see happen.
This is Jenny Spohr, and I should mention Reverend Jenny Spohr. She got her ordination in the Presbyterian Church with the language of Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, that he got his ordination to do Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Uh-huh. And they listened to our show and thought, this is just like Fred Rogers. It's for children. And so she got her ordination, and Reverend Jenny Spohr. Thank you, Jenny. Yeah. We'll be back with more of the Kindlings Moves coming up right after this. Dick Staubach with you, listening to Kindlings Muse live from Kindlings Fest 2011 on Orcas Island. And would that you folks listening to the podcast could look at my socks and Nigel's shoes. Let's stand up on our chairs, Nigel, and give the folks out in the listening audience a little view of what's going on here. Yeah, baby. Woo! So, there you go. So, Nigel, when we talked about... go ahead. Please don't interrupt me. It's my show, but please.
Is there any substance to this?
Nigel, so we're now 2 days into this exploration of mourning into dancing, and what are some of the things that you would reflect on in terms of the work that we've been doing together in community?
In the last few days, you mean, or
yes.
In our lives
No, you
together?
Don't have to start at 1948. No, please. Just yesterday and today.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, struck me this morning, Chuck, saying that weeping tears came before the flood.
Yeah.
So that water is intentional in the heart of the great artist. And anybody who culturally says, little boys don't cry, is nuts. Thank you, on cue. Because if you don't cry, you don't become a man or a woman. I guess it's why most women live a lot longer than most guys, because they're better at screaming. They're better at letting it all hang out, right? And we guys need to learn to let it all hang out. I'm not talking about Dick Storb now.
Or Eric. As Michael said, he does need to be... Yeah, Michael Card said you need to be stopped. He's a Bible teacher. So it must be right.
Yeah, and so I think that we have spent, and we probably should spend, a good part of this gathering in the morning side of it. I think, as Michael said this morning, recognizing that we are in the wilderness, all of us. Nobody is any more in the wilderness than anybody else. That's where we are. And but, as I tried to say this morning, we are also called. It's an obedience, it's a calling. Each one of us has a place to tend the garden, to caretake on this planet. And we're hearing tonight just something about that. Justice isn't something that some people do. It's something that everybody's concerned about. And one of the exciting things, I think, about this next generation, this generation with us now, our kids and our grandkids, is that they're not talking about the pain of the planet, they're engaging it. They're engaging the pain of the planet at every level of society. And we should be applauding that, really applauding that. Will you clap that?
Thanks, Nigel. You know, a few years ago, I met somebody at Kindlingsfest who's sitting right in front of me here, Matthew Wickstrom. And I learned something that artists think in pictures, not words. And I knew that, but when I saw his notes of lectures, it had a whole new meaning for me. I'd like to put up on the screen his notes from yesterday's lecture. That's what he did. That's actually today's lecture, isn't it? Because it's got...
It's the yesterday's. It's dated. You can't see it. July 27, 2011.
So that was yesterday?
That was yesterday morning, yeah.
Okay, let's look at the next one. This is what he does... every Sunday after church, whoever's speaking here, he will bring one of these up. And it's his notes from the sermon. And it's amazing. It's amazing to think about the way artists and each of us process things and think about things. Today, he showed me one, and he ran out of ink. And it was very simple. And you may not be able to see it. It's a pencil drawing. Can you read what it says up there?
I want mom... I want not my idea of mom. I want mom, and it just keeps on going on.
And then it says,
"I want."
And at the bottom,
love.
What I didn't mention is that when I first met Matthew, he was here with his mother, who's an artist, an amazing artist, and she died just a few months ago of cancer, and it was very sudden, and. I mean, that's immediately where this simple drawing this morning took me. And whether it's I want mom or I want whatever it is that you've lost, it's such an amazing capturing of what he's feeling. And
Dick, I love that thing in Shadowlands when C.S. Lewis says to Joy, who's dying of cancer. And he says, I don't want to lose you, Joy. And she says, I don't want to be lost. You know, it's really important to know that mom isn't lost. Mom is found. And but we grieve because she's not on the telephone. And we can't give her a drawing. And we can't send her a postcard. But she is found. She's fully found. And we need to get stronger in that. Stronger in the fully foundness of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and William Wilberforce. Stronger in the fully foundness of our loved ones. Hmm.
There is another part to the story. And that is that... the year before his mother died, God brought into his life an amazing woman named Andrea. And I was talking with Matt's dad the weekend of the memorial service, and I said, isn't it amazing how God, in Matthew's case, saw that he needed somebody in his life. And as mom, who was his greatest influence, passed from the scene, this lovely woman came into his life, and they were married 4 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago. I did the wedding, but who's counting? Would you guys just stand up and be bathed in applause and love? I'm going to ask John Hoyt to come up now. And, you know, I loved what Michael Card said this morning about we shouldn't rush too quickly out of mourning. And that mourning actually has its purpose. And as a matter of fact, he said a case could be made that the rest of our journey on earth will have a certain aspect of that pain and suffering and mourning, because it's not going to be completely gone until the Lord takes us to be with him. And so I don't want to suggest in the Matthew and Andrew story that it's always going to work out that way. It just was the way God's grace was expressed in their case. And I'll tell you, doing your wedding was such a great, great joy, because I know that God provided you for each other. And I just think it's wonderful that he did it in the way God does. Perfect timing. Perfect timing. So, well, one of the things that happens at an event like this is we get reconnected with old friends and new. And the next person that we're going to be speaking with has been a friend of both Nigel and I for a long time. And John Hoyt is the husband of Lucy Shaw, the poet, many of you know. She was here last year. And she was going to be here this year, but she fell and hurt her back. And we've been praying for her and ask you to do the same. But the thing that Lucy always says about John is she says, I just have no comprehension of how he is so positive and optimistic all the time. Are you any married to somebody like that? And you just look at him like, oh, please. I mean, come on. Things are really bad here. And John is very upbeat. And so the thing that amazes people, and we're not going to have time to get into all of his journey, but is that he has had a tough journey that could have made him very bitter. For instance, how old were you when you were put in a Japanese internment camp in China? You need your mic.
I was 9 years old and badly missing my mom and dad, because they had been sent by the Missionary Society to Lanzhou, which is 2,000 miles inland in China. And we were all six of us siblings were in a boarding school on the coast when the World War II started. So I was 9, and the Japanese came marching into town. There was cavalry, like World War I. But they took the whole boarding school and put it into a prison camp. So we were there till the duration of the war, about 3.5 years.
So from 9 to 12 and a half.
Nine till the early 13.
And where were you in the order of these six kids?
I was second from youngest. So I had three brothers, one sister, and then Mary, and then I came, and then Elizabeth was younger than me.
Were you able to be with each other all the time in the camp?
That was theoretically true, but we've stayed very much with our own grades of my friends. So we weren't a close family, which was very hard. I think my eldest brother, who felt he was responsible for us other five, felt the pressure of that, because with mom and dad far away, he actually had a mental breakdown after the war because of the responsibility. And it's quite a few kids did not quite recover from the separation during the war. But it was a remarkable time, because the Japanese did not kill us or torture us, but we just had to live through very harsh conditions, very cold winters, no fuel. I got chilblains on my toes and fingers, and the food was terribly monotonous and inadequate. You could see our ribs after the war, but we generally survived pretty well. But the separation from mom and dad was the worst, was hard. And particularly, and when Susan shared about her mother's death, tears came to my eyes, because there was a day when the head teacher of our school called us six kids into his hut in the camp and said he had just heard from my dad that my mother had died. And what was particularly hard was that we hoped it wasn't true. We thought it may be a lie, that, you know, because there was rumors coming and going. We just wished it wasn't true. So in a way, our grieving, our mourning went on and on and on. And I remember my sister Mary saying that every night she just cried herself to sleep because, you know, a mother had meant so much to us and our mom. And that was the grieving, the worst, far worse than the prison camp and the Japanese guards. I mean, it was a real camp with searchlights and electrified wire and all the rest. But the separation and then the loss of mom and the hope that it wasn't true until after the war we met dad down in Hong Kong and she wasn't there, so we knew it was true. But it was a remarkable camp. Eric Little in the Chariots of Fire, he was part of the dance in the camp because we loved him. He was very modest about his gold medal in the Olympics of 1924. And he was great with us kids. He taught us games and kept the morale up. And I keep on thinking, what a wonderful example of grieving. All of us were grieving in that camp. Deprivation, hunger, a cold. And yet there were people like Eric who kept the dance going. That was remarkable.
Was he married? Did he have a wife in the camp?
No. Well, unfortunately, he was married, and he had sent his wife and two daughters ahead. They were going to go back to Scotland. But then the war came, and they got stuck in Canada, and he was going to follow. But then he couldn't escape from China, so he was put into the camp with the rest of us.
Wow.
But it was a real privilege to know him. And he was, I remember attending his funeral outside the camp and as one of the honor guard, because we children were special to him. And it was out in the fields, way in the desolates of January, a cold, cold winter. And I like to compare that to the Chariots of Fire, the Abraham's funeral in St. Paul's Cathedral with the great singing of the choir. And here was the Eric Little, nobody would hear of this funeral out in the wasteland of China. And yet, who do we think of now? It's Eric, not Abraham's.
Wow.
Remarkable.
It is remarkable. Yeah. So now, were you by nature a positive kid?
I suppose I must have been, but I suppose some of that being positive was our way of surviving the difficulties, the frustration of being separated from mom and dad. But I used to sketch. Now this sketching here reminds me that I sketched my way through survival. I've got little sketches that I had right the way through the camp.
Wow.
And I keep them still in a little sketchbook, sketches in a Japanese prison camp, and that's one of my hobbies.
Oh, I'm forgetting her name. The Jewish Museum in New York this year had an exhibit. She was in one of the prison camps, one of the Nazi prison camps. She was an artist, and she would have children draw in the prison camp, and hid their work. The Nazis didn't know that she was doing this art with these kids. And these kids, some of them are still living, tell that's what got them through the camp. And a lot of that art survives, and it was in this exhibit. I'll post it at our website because we did do a piece about it. Do you know her name?
I'm trying to think.
She was amazing, and she died in the camp.
Yeah. She died.
Yeah, okay. But... that's fascinating. Yeah. So now, were there some things you learned about being upbeat through that experience that you think have been part of your life since then?
Well, my friendships there. There was also a Salvation Army band that came into the camp with their instruments.
Oh my gosh.
Sunday afternoon, the band would play hymns and so on out in the central courtyard where we had a roll call twice a day. When we had the number, the Japanese guards would parade us, and we'd all have to shout out our number. But in that same parade ground, the band would keep singing, playing their instruments. So I think children are resilient too. I tend to forget the difficulties, and you remember the good ones too. And having brothers, three brothers older than me, that kept me going too. So trying to catch up with my three eldest brothers.
Now, some years later. You lost a wife to cancer.
Yes.
And Lucy Shaw, at a similar time, was losing her husband to cancer.
Yes, she lost Harold.
Just tell us a little bit about how the two of you got together and how God turned mourning into dancing.
That is a wonderful story of God's great grace. Because Lucy had lost her Harold, I think about 6 years earlier. And a friend of our mutual friend, the Coopers, they were lived up in Vancouver, knew us both. And when Alma had died, they thought that maybe Lucy and I might get to know each other. So they sent me Lucy's book, God in the Dark, which is an incredible book about mourning her husband. It's a journal of the loss of her husband through cancer, but with incredible perception, and ends up with dancing. So I thought, wow, it'd be wonderful just to meet this woman. I mean, it was so incredible. And then they arranged that we might meet in Vancouver on a blind date. So,
how old were you both at this time?
Well, that was 20 years ago. So it was I was 60, 67.
Wow.
So and then.
So you can blind date at 67.
Yeah.
And actually, it can be literally true at 67 for some people. Which may be a blessing.
Right.
But anyway.
But anyway, you know, amazing, because after spending that first weekend with some time together, she was traveling to India with the International Bible Society and would travel and then went back to Chicago. And I felt just moved to call her, Lucy, I want to come and see you. So I flew out. This is the second time we've been together. And that first night, we were standing on the veranda of her sixth floor building in Wheaton. And I proposed to her, and she said, yes. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it just took me by surprise. It was wonderful. So it was like a kid.
It's almost,
you know,
like being in love.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It was really wonderful. Second date, here we were engaged. Because the problem of telling my kids this.
Telling your parents. Hi, Mom.
Telling my kids I'm engaged to this woman. So they, of course, had never met her or anything. So that was 20 years ago, so it was great.
You think it's going to last?
God did turn my morning into wonderful dancing.
So if you could give a word of advice to people here tonight who are carrying some serious mourning with them, what would it be?
I'd say look through the glass, the window of pain, beyond it, and see beyond it the love of God. I mean, I experienced his love through all of this. And I went through the British Army, and that was a very tough time for me. But that's when I really came to know Christ in a more personal way. And that changed my army boot camp experience into dancing, because it was very tough. So basically, looking beyond to the faithfulness and the love that Christ can provide beyond the immediate pain. And because he bore this pain, he understands pain and understands mourning.
That's fascinating and amazing. Thank you so much for being with us. This is Dick Staub. You've been listening to the Kindlings Muse live at Kindlings Fest 2011. We've been talking with John Hoyt, and we'll be back next time with more of the Kindlings Muse.